been my observation over the years that a trader's bank balance will very, very rarely exceed the level of their own emotional intelligence. These people are very noisy, and they have a message that is very seductive, and it's very much along the lines of, you can give up your day job with $10,000 and start day trading Bitcoin. They do something very clever. They sell a dream that they target very, very carefully, that presents a way out for people that is easy. And one of the things I learned very, very quickly was that all I had to do was to be 1% calmer than the people around me. And I introduced that sense of calm by introducing a pause. And the pause was a deep breath.
Welcome to the Alpha Mind Podcast. My name is Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host is Mark Randall. Today's guest is Chris Tate. Chris is an Aussie trader who's calling us from down under, and he's worked in the market since the 1980s. And, well, actually, we're going to let him tell you all about who he is when he introduces himself in the podcast, but we're going to do something a little bit different today. At the end of this brilliant interview, we went off mic, and we just started chatting and talking a little bit about a few things. And one of the things we talked about was some of the dark side, the dark aspects of trading and financial markets, how there's some unscrupulous people out there basically defrauding people out of their money, selling them services which are totally inadequate, and there's also quite a few people offering substandard and sub-quality services, luring people into this business, taking their money. You know, in a sense, what we're doing at Alpha Mind, there's a sense of a project about it. We do feel there's a lot of bad education out there. There's some good education as well, but the quality of it misleads people. They're missold about expectations. Often many of their expectations are unrealistic, and in a sense we feel that, you know, if we perhaps give our own thoughts and perspectives, it might add something to it that can help people and give them perhaps a better chance of succeeding. So in the same sense, the work Chris is doing now also veers in that direction. And, well, I'm going to let you listen to this first part, which is about 7 minutes long. I hope you enjoy it.
It's always a pleasure to talk to people who have a desire to do the right thing, because one of the things I used to do when I retired as a sort of a hobby was expert witness work. The people who'd been ripped off by spruikers in these magic options trading schemes. And I found it immensely distressing after a while as to how many people got toasted by people doing the wrong thing deliberately. And so it's refreshing to spend an evening talking with people who are trying to do the right thing.
Are you finding down there in Australia that there are people in your space that just got no authenticity, they haven't got the experience, but they're turning up in their hordes to try to get access to this wallet?
Yeah, we are up to our eyeballs in donks, ripoff merchants. Bitcoin has been very problematic for us in terms of the number of people that's dragged out of the woodwork. And you probably experience the same thing in that your message gets drowned in the noise, because these people are very noisy. And they have a message that is very seductive, and it's very much along the lines of, you can give up your day job with $10,000 and start day trading Bitcoin. Okay, how do you combat that as a message when that's the message that people actually want to hear? That the majority of the sort of naive market think that's real, and these people present, probably as they do in the UK, as being very real, very slick. They're extremely sophisticated in their approach, and they make our life very hard.
Yeah, you're right. These are very seductive messages. Even my brother-in-law came up to me about 4 or 5 years ago, and then he's a very successful businessman. He's made a lot of money over the years. And he came to me and he said, Steve, someone's put me into one of these binary option trading schemes, guaranteed to make you money. And I'm like, I can't believe you're such a smart guy, and yet you've fallen for this. And luckily, I steered him away from it. And I've managed to steer a lot of people away from schemes and programs like me, you know, friends, brothers and sisters of friends who, you know, that they, you're right, these messages are very seductive, that they're presented brilliantly, they look authentic, and, you know, even smart people get, you know, smart people get trapped into it because other smart people get trapped into
it. Fall for as well. I've had some friends who are highly intelligent, highly sophisticated in their own field, and they have fallen for the most outrageously stupid scams that I have really ever come across.
Yeah.
But because they're presented so articulately and they are so seductive as a message, then, and they present this, they do something very clever. They sell a dream that they target very, very carefully, that presents a way out for people that is easy. Because one of the things I have noticed, more particularly even over the past few years, is that often people want to be somebody else. And so they present them with this seductive, romantic notion of being somebody else. I've got friends who I would consider have had the ideal career. They've been fighter pilots for years. They now fly Qantas A380s around the world. They want to be somebody else. I've got friends who are high-performing surgeons who do remarkable things, highly trained individuals. They want to be someone else or lead a different life. And for some reason, the message that these individuals present seems to lock in on something in their psyche. And it's both fascinating and terrifying to watch. It's a little bit like the first time you see a shark. It is fascinating and terrifying. And
yeah.
How they're combated, I don't know. I really don't know.
I saw something on LinkedIn on Investment Professionals Network a couple of weeks ago. And it's presented by someone who's an economist, or at least he's put himself out there as an economist, who knows. And it says, would making 70% on your funds within a year after all fees be okay for you? You know, from 10K to 17K in a year. And then he presents all the data on this system. And it's clearly a back-tested, curve-fitted system that's produced great returns in a year. And to the, I could see people so easily falling for that. You know, I mean, that looks great. You know, wow. So you can see how easily people are manipulated into that. You know, especially if it's presented as someone really intelligent. You know, we don't even know if this guy on LinkedIn really exists. You know, there's a picture of him, it could be anyone. So
it's intriguing how LinkedIn has become Facebook for people with a job. My feed is currently being polluted by, this is going to sound uncharitable. They all seem to be Eastern Europeans selling algorithmic trading systems with all sorts of wonderful data, and an equity curve that starts bottom left, ends top right, and has no drawdown. And you think, hang on, I've never seen an equity curve like, no, I have actually, it was Bernie Madoff's and that was a scam. Maybe that's telling me something about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a fascinating business.
Yeah, it's easy money for them. You know, they put it on a different name every day. They set up an account for them in a system. And, you know, I always feel, you know, generally it's people with pensions who are retired who I think fall for this very easily. You know, they've got a lot of time in their hands and they're behind a screen. And that's heartbreaking for me because, you know, these are people who've worked and saved all their life. And, you know, these people, they're vulnerable.
Yes. And that's, again, you see the other side of human nature, which is, it's not surprising in any way, shape or form, because, you know, you see it all the time, but it is still distressing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the monetary authorities don't do a thing.
It will always continue to be the same. The model will change, but, you know, if there's easy money to be made from vulnerable people, or even people that succumb to the seduction, then it's going to happen.
It's everything from the Nigerian prince to someone who's going to paint your roof or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're very careful with who they target. But it is what it is, and you can only continue to fight the good fight.
I hope you enjoyed that and found it useful. Now we're going to go ahead with the main chat now. Before we start, just a quick thank you from myself and Mark for some of the outstanding feedback we've received from people on social media about the Alpha Mind podcast. We're really pleased with the way it's going, and we're delighted that this week we were informed that we'd made it into the top 1,000 business podcasts on iTunes in the US, which we're just 3 months' work and not really any advertising at all, other than a few social media prompts. It shows that we've really seemed to have touched on an issue with these intangible aspects of trading, the focus on mindset, behavior, psychology, emotions, the mental aspects. So once again, thank you very much. And in that vein, if you do enjoy it, please go onto iTunes and rate us. That helps get us even further up the iTunes charts, helps us get noticed, helps spread our message to a wider audience. Now, on with the main interview. Welcome, Chris Tate from Australia. It's great to have you on the Alpha Mind podcast. Maybe you can just tell our audience a little bit about you, who you are, and the work you're doing.
All right. My background is a little bit sort of different from the traditional background, which I think is more of an advantage than a disadvantage. My working life began as a research scientist. My interest has always been the human immune system, and in particular viral cancers. My trading began by happenstance in the 80s. I caught the 1980s bull market, and the worst thing that could have possibly happened to a trader happened to me. Everything I bought went up. And I, of course, internalized that and thought I was a genius. When I found out I wasn't a genius, I thought, well, I'd probably better learn something about this malarkey. And I was getting sick of academia. The academic model in the UK is the same as it here is in Australia. It's full of politics, paperwork, grants, undergraduates. And after a while, you get sick of that. The science is fascinating. The money is terrible. The work conditions are annoying. And so I talked my way into a broking house. And I did so purely on the strength of the fact that I had an account with them. But I also had a Hewlett-Packard 15C calculator, which is, it's like the 12C financial calculators, but a scientific version, in that it has no equals button. And they were absolutely fascinated by the fact the calculator could operate without an equals button. I spent many years in broking my sort of gig, if you would, for want of a better word, was derivatives. And so managed money institutionally, set up derivatives dealing desks around the place, eventually got sick of broking because it is not the most pleasant of environments. Whenever you mix large amounts of money and young men, you do tend to get an environment that's fairly toxic, and was fortunate enough to retire at 30, write some books, lecture at business schools when I wanted to, got bored with retirement because that's a middle-class concept. I now run a company with my business partner called Trading Game, where we look at very much along the lines of what you do. We have a slightly mechanistic approach, but our approach is to drag people kicking and screaming towards the psychology of trading and behavioral finance. So it's to get them to a point where they can trade any market over any time frame, but it's actually their plan. And they have the mental framework and the emotional currency to be able to do so. And that probably brings us up to date with my CV.
Wow, I mean, that was very succinctly put, which was great. And lots of questions which have already popped into my head. One of them, which is quite pertinent to me, is this idea of, I call it beginner's luck. You talked about your first trades being on the right side of the market and you thinking you're a genius. I've written some articles and posted some tweets about the dangers of beginner's luck and almost how so many of the traders who have achieved great success started with actually some large failures. I think in one of our previous podcasts with a trader, Adam Nash, he talked about how there's a lot of traders he's worked with who start off with some beginner's luck, that they find a rich seam or a system very early in their career, and they start making quite a bit of money. And then that goes wrong somewhere pretty well, maybe after 6 months or a year, it starts to go wrong, and they never recover from it because they've really credited themselves as being an early genius.
Yes, I think what that shows, if you look at the individual, what that shows, I think, is the difference between a very fixed mindset and a growth mindset. And as we know, people with a fixed mindset simply say, I'm very clever, I'm being rewarded for being very clever, people tell me I'm very clever. And then when something goes wrong, there is no framework for them to operate within which says, well, perhaps you're not as clever as you thought, why don't you rethink the problem? Whereas people with a growth mindset, I think, look at the world through a vastly different prism. They look at it through that notion. I think it was Marie Curie who said that in the world there is nothing to be feared, only things to be understood. And so people with a growth mindset take a step back and they take it as a learning lesson. And you see this with children. If you have children who are on sort of the borderline of gifted. For years, they get by on natural talent and horsepower, but sooner or later that runs out. But because of the framework they've been given, they have no skills to come back on. So they have this sort of internalized diatribe, which begins to tell them they're not as clever as they thought they were. They're as clever as they're ever going to be, and this is where they're stuck. But children who seem to have, or who have given, been given a different framework, so instead of being told they're clever, they're told that's an excellent approach to learning and solving that problem. Walk me through how you did it. And so they have a completely different mindset. And the terrible thing about markets is whilst we know objectively that they don't know that you exist, it really does seem like they do know that you're there sometimes and they're out to teach you a lesson or they're out to teach you how to trade badly. And my experience is the same as everybody else who started off with a bang. You run into a brick wall and then you're presented with a binary decision. What do you do? Do you give up or do you try and pick yourself up and learn from the experience? And mine was simply, well, I really have to pick myself up and do something with the experiences that I've accumulated to date.
It's a very interesting, this concept of just mindset delivers either a successful path or a tragic path. And of course, you talked about beginner's luck, and throughout someone's trading career, there may be spells where they suddenly get lucky for a run. And they get carried away with that luck, and then they fail, and then it suddenly becomes a problem, because actually an awful lot of people that interact with and face the market don't have anything to manage themselves in terms of a toolkit. They've not been educated in that way. In fact, life's become so complex that they sort of overanalyze the problem, so it becomes an even worse problem. Youngsters, of course, with their more natural self, haven't got that bias. They just get on with it, bounce back, learn. And getting back to your natural self, certainly from the work that I've done and certainly had the impact on traders in the market, getting back to that state allows them to have a mindset of, you know, resilience, bounce back, learn, and actually a more balanced view to the way that they manage their ups and downs, you know. So they're learning to not overplay the ups, so that, you know, you just keep yourself grounded all the time.
And that's undoubtedly true, and it's been my observation as well. Where I do see a little bit of a schism or complication is in this current generation of traders who've come up behind us, in that they exist in an echo chamber. And their echo chambers are not very positive. I think, I wonder whether in 20 or 30 years' time, we will not look back at social media like we now look back at smoking as a harm to society, no matter what we're being told. Because, I mean, we all know how algorithms work for social media. If you look up something negative, that will be endlessly repeated back to you to the point where you get nothing else but that. I mean, as an experiment on YouTube, I simply looked up sloths because my business partner's daughter is obsessed by sloths. Why? I have no idea. 12-year-old girls, they're just strange. And within a week, all YouTube showed me was videos on sloths doing silly things. So what you're saying is true and correct. But I think there's this awful added complication now of the amount of information traders receive and the tone of that information. And it's one of the problems we have had when dealing with traders is divorcing them from the information so they can actually sit with themselves, which is profoundly difficult for people under the most ideal of circumstances. Getting people to just sit and be still is profoundly difficult. And I would be very interested to hear about how you've gone about sort of getting people to that state where they can sit and begin to work out what their natural state of being actually is.
This echo chamber is a huge problem. It's something which is, If I go back to when I started trading, I was a trader, probably started about the same time as you. I worked for a Japanese bank in the mid 80s, and then I was given a book in 1987. And when I started and when Mark started in 1981, we had people around us to learn from. Mark was on the trading floor. I was in a dealing room, as they used to be called in those days.
And in the old days?
In the old days, yes. I don't know when they changed from dealing rooms to trading rooms. I missed that.
No, neither did I.
When the money shifted.
that's a very good point.
The point was you learnt from everyone around you. You learnt from people who were good at something or had been in the seat for a while. You saw what was bad. In a way, you had some brutal learnings, and they were brutal days in many respects. And, you had to be quite tough to suffer that and survive. And I think there was always an element of that. But that was also sort of training as well, in a sense. And the people coming through today, the people in the retail world, which is, it's overwhelmingly the vast majority of the market now. They don't have that. They're sitting at home behind a screen following Twitter. And, there are mentoring services out there. And I think some, in a way, without mentoring, I don't know how people do it. I'm sure there's one or two people who manage to come through that world without mentoring. But nearly everyone I know who succeeded, somewhere in their early days, they had mentors. They had people around them, people they could talk to, people who gave them an encouraging word at a key moment,
yes,
or directed them on a path. And I'm a huge believer in the value of mentoring services. I coach traders now, but it's not a mentoring service. I don't work with what I would call beginners or new traders or novices. And when they do contact me, I normally try and direct them to a mentoring service. But I wonder where they get that from. I don't know how good they are. Some of the people I've met and come across seem very genuine, and hopefully we're going to have a few of them on the show in the next couple of months. I'm quite careful to sort of try and pick out ones that strike me as genuine. But it is a tough thing, how do you get into this world that, most people make the mistake of coming in and thinking they can succeed in a few months. And really, it's a huge skill which takes years. The people I know who have succeeded took years to start making money. Again, my generation was lucky in that, when we worked at a bank, their expectations were that we were going to, just learn the job in the first couple of years. And they really didn't expect too much of us for the first two or three years. We had to show a little bit of promise, a little bit of guile.
A little bit of nous,
yeah. But they didn't expect too much from us in those early days. And again, I'm... Do you know what? I don't think I really became a good trader till I was probably 13 years into my job, which might seem strange. I survived. I had some good early successes. I had some big early failures. And I would say I survived as a mediocre trader for probably most of my trading career, and then became, I would say, good at it very late in my career. If you're working for yourself, you don't have that luxury of time to that degree.
Can I just butt in there on something?
This
path that we've had from, fortunate path that we've had from actually being in proper trading areas and proper dealing room areas, where you learn that you feel the market, you sense the market. And of course, people come in to the market now that are young, that are in this sort of always on, always connected, need for immediate response type world. And an awful lot of them maybe have come from, the FIFA world, or where we had a gaming world. They play games. Yes. They kind of think that getting into the market is like playing a game. And when they get into the market, they realize it's just a bit and off. It's not a game at all. It's a sort of a flat, two-dimensional price on a screen that you can look at a two-dimensional chart, but and can you feel the market? You can't feel the market in that way. Yes. So their challenge is, all of a sudden, they then got to realize that they're playing with a different world that's not a game. They're playing with a world that they have to see and try to figure out, maybe with, you know, not a lot of experience. And yet this compulsion of, I've got to be always on. I've got to be always doing something. And, of course, that leads to an awful lot of mistakes going on. So they can't settle and be quiet. And they've got to be on. And I've seen, you know, kids will, you know, or an awful lot of people in their sort of mid-years, you know, binging on box sets, you know, that type of culture of not stepping away. And yet we know that the power of trading is the ability to sort of step away, to watch, be and patient, and do nothing, yes, and, you know, choose your time appropriately. And that's a skill, but I don't think current culture sort of develops that skill.
No, and I think part of the issue, one of the things you learn from groups, whether it be groups you work with, groups you play sport with, or whatever, family groups, is the notion of accountability. And accountability is a great teacher, because you're held accountable to the group and in turn held accountable to yourself. And I don't think, again, this glorious isolation people put themselves in, there is no accountability. Yes, you can look at your P&L at the end of the day and go, well, it's red. But in the grand scheme of things, what does that really mean? And I think this is part of the problem with that this particular generation have, is that, as you rightly said, their sense of fear of missing out is so amped up, and that they are in such isolation that I don't know what the statistics are like in the UK, but when I moved out of home, I moved into university digs, then moved into a share house. Young people don't do that now. For some reason, they want to live alone in a flat. They don't eat out. They get Uber Eats or something. And everything they do is through the interface of their phone. It's not through the interface of human contact. And I actually think in terms of dealing, in terms of trading, if you have no understanding of humans and how they function, how they work, their extremes of emotion, their fear, their anger, their greed, their regret, then markets must be an immensely confusing place to you, because you come from a world that you see through the prism of a small phone screen. So when emotions are writ large on the screen, you look at something and go, I've got nothing. I don't really understand. And as you say, they're trying to translate a two-dimensional picture into a broader, more macro understanding of the world. And that's profoundly difficult if you don't have the skills. And one of the skills you do learn in a dealing room is to navigate other people. And that's an essential skill. You've got to learn to work with them, manage them, put up with those of them who are complete dickheads, of which there are many in broking. But they're all valuable skills.
Yeah. But it's this idea of navigating. I often talk to people and I say to them, it's not the market that you're fighting, really. Actually, it's not you against the market. You're navigating a terrain. That's what it is. It's you're encountering it every day and you're navigating a path through it. You're not trying to beat it, because it's not trying to beat you. You know, you can only compete against something that's competing against you.
And yes.
It is just out there. It's like a natural force.
But don't you find that is that strange thing of, particularly young men, and I can only speak to them because I've only ever been one of those, have this combative approach. And it's not helped by when they read books and you get, what is the quote by Rothschilds, that says, buy when you have blood in the streets. But you have all these metaphors and this notion of competition. And you can't, A, compete against something that doesn't really exist, You know, you can't. It's difficult to compete against something that has a manifestation in your head. The analogy I use for markets and the metaphor I use is, it's like surfing. You cannot control the waves. You will rock up to the beach on some days and it will be like a mill pond and you'll think, bugger, let's go to the pub. This is rubbish. There'll be some days that are brilliant and you will talk to your mates about forever. There will be some days that you talk to your mates about forever for the wrong reason, because a really big wave roars up and slams you into the ground. And there'll be other days you talk about where a mate of yours swims up underneath you, touches your foot, and someone yells shark. But you can't do anything about the behavior of waves. You just have to accept what they give you. And yeah, it is that notion of acceptance. It is the most powerful one I find for new traders, but it's very hard to get them to a metaphor or some imagery that removes all the combative stress. So it removes all that cognitive and somatic anxiety that people build up when presented with a problem. They have a very relaxed approach then, but it's so hard to get them there.
I use the same analogy. I use the sea. I use it in a sailing sense, but it's a great analogy because it's a natural force. You have no control over it. And that's the same about the market. It is really a natural force. It is a force of nature. It's millions of people all making decisions, whether independently or together, that push the market one way or another. And those decisions react to the decisions that other people made. And it is a natural force. And yes, there is some outside influence on it from, you know, governments and central banks that will affect it occasionally. But you forget that. It is a natural force. And, you know, every sailor will tell you, every ship's captain, you respect the sea. You can't beat it. You can't fight it. You have to respect it. And if you don't respect it, it will sink you. And that's the same with markets.
But the market is us.
Yes.
We're creating
the currents, but you know, we're creating them en masse. You know, except for a few illiquid markets, you know, it is the force of nature. You know, there are millions of people all involved in the decisions that lead to the price action, and we cannot know what that decision is. It's impossible. And if you try and rationalize it, you can't, because there's just too many ever-changing variables that affect it.
I mean, mathematicians would call it a chaotic system, but in actual fact, it's better described by population ecology, because population ecology deals with natural systems that ebb and flow. And once you understand, you use a sailing analogy, you use a surfing analogy, it doesn't matter what it is. Once you accept that you have this natural system, which you are intimately linked to, because you have perceptions of it, it feeds back into you, you try and feed back into that, I find life becomes so much easier, because you can introduce this notion of a pause, you can introduce stillness. You actually get to experience the notion of mindfulness. It's actually very hard to teach people who've got busy heads and inappropriate metaphors how to be mindful and present, because there doesn't seem to be an emotional scaffolding for them to cling on to. They struggle to find out who they are and where they sit, which is a problematic thing for a trader, because I don't know what your experience is, but if you can't grasp that as a fundamental, as a truth, then everything that comes beyond that, it doesn't matter which guru you follow, which indicator you use, which market you trade, at the end of the day, will probably end in tears unless you get exceptionally lucky.
No, I think, and it's good for you to bring back this point, I think we're sort of gagging to sort of explore it further, the concept of a personal toolkit at a foundation to any approach to the market, to have that ability to know how to sit still and experience the uncomfortable, not react to it, not to dwell on it, not to let it reappear at a later date to, you know, ambush your strategy. And, you know, mindfulness is a very broad term, and of course there is sort of sometimes stigma about it, sometimes that it's you know, too aligned to the Buddha preachings. But I mean, I see it as something that we've always had, going back in to the, you know, millennia of time, this ability to just sit and just notice and just be with yourself, and, you know, not jump onto the thought bandwagon and be with them, but to just notice them as to what they are and just let them go. But there's huge strength, and certainly you can see from some of the, you know, the big investors that they all do some sort of self-practice, and it's important to find something that suits you. Some people orientate it towards sports, you know, so there's the present moment awareness and tuning into your senses, but through some sort of sporting engagement rather than, you know, sitting for you know, moments of meditation. So there are different yes. things that suit different people, and I would certainly encourage the population of listeners that, you know, if you've not got that process, manage yourself, and that's self in capitals,
yes.
then go and get it. Because it will. Because if you can sort that out and have that as your kind of like your guiding natural direction, kind of like your default state, then when you're making big decisions, they're easier. When you're needing to sit there and just watch and be patient, it's easier. When you need yes. to get over something that suddenly turned up as maybe a big loss or a relationship challenge or whatever, you've got a toolkit to just manage it. And we've got that as kids. You know, we're born with that toolkit, but we kind of lose it through the journey of time.
We will return to the podcast shortly, but first, some insight into Alpha Mind. Alpha Mind is a collaboration between two market veterans, Stephen Goldstein and Mark Randall. Stephen is a former professional trader who now works as a coach to people and businesses in financial markets. His business, Alpha R Cubed, provides mindset coaching to traders and investment professionals at all levels, and executive and team coaching to financial market businesses. Stephen sees trading as a dual challenge. That is, the tangible challenge against the markets and the mindset challenge that people have to overcome themselves. The two of these are closely connected. However, it is the intangible aspects of trading where he specializes as a coach. You can check out his and Alpha R Cubed's work at alpharcubed.com. That is the letter R, or email info@alpharcubed.com if you'd like to know more about their work. Mark Randall has over 30 years working as a professional broker in the industry. Mark used mindfulness techniques to enable him to optimize his performance to be at his best for his clients. Later in his career, he started giving talks, seminars, and workshops to corporate leaders and investment businesses about how to apply and use mindfulness to work more effectively and productively. His form of mindfulness is based on the same techniques and processes used by the US military special forces. Mark has developed his practice into what he calls mind fitness, a form of military-grade mindfulness. If you are interested to know more about Mark and how he can help you and your business, he can be contacted at ceo@markrandallconsultancy.com. Now back to the podcast.
You know, perhaps you can develop that more from some of your experience in the space around, from your perspective, the sense of what you do from the sense of mindfulness, or what you would encourage people to do?
My view has always been that there is no problem that we cannot make worse by our own impulsive actions. I'll give you an autobiographical case in point. I worked my way through university as a bouncer. I worked at pubs, clubs, concerts and the like. And one of the things I learnt very, very quickly was that all I had to do was to be 1% calmer than the people around me. And I introduced that sense of calm by introducing a pause. And the pause was a deep breath before doing anything. And that brought in a circuit breaker for me, because if you've ever been to a pub here in Australia, you will notice that generally people working on the door are Pacific Islanders. They're generally Maori. And they only come in one size, jumbo economy size. They're like Easter Island statues. They're huge. And as someone who stands nearly 6'4 and is 110 kilos, for me to say someone is big, they're really big. But the problem is, because of a variety of cultural impediments they had, their first response to every problem was violence. So if someone was arcing up, they would immediately roar into the middle of a confrontation and literally go off their heads, which solved nothing. I learned a great deal by walking into the middle of a confrontation, having taken a breath, touching someone on the arm and going, "Come on, son, don't be silly. Tell me what the problem is." My calmness was infectious. Now, I'm not saying you can infect the market with your own calm, but you can have this moment where all the uncertainty of the market disappears, the emotional intensity disappears, because once the emotional intensity disappears, your IQ comes back online and you're free to make more considered decisions, because there is always time. I was having this chat with a friend of mine who's a surgeon, and they have what's known as step back, where even in the most dire of circumstances, they will all take a moment before doing anything just to briefly chat, assess, again, take a deep breath, and then go. And it is one of these things that it's intriguing how Eastern cultures have this as a bedrock. I'm a keen fan of yoga. Yoga has pause, composure, intention before each move. Before you move, yoga to the outside person just looks like very skinny men in loincloths flopping around on the ground. And to a degree, there is a little bit of that, which is disconcerting for outsiders. But before you do anything, there's a pause. You compose yourself during the pause and you move with intention. And whilst it seems like they all join together and there's no time at all, for those of us who are practiced at it, there is always time. And you see this in athletes. When you look at tennis players, the very, very, very good ones seem to have so much more time than anyone else. And it's not reflexive, because the human nervous system has an upper limit. It can't move any quicker than it does for the majority of people. But something happens with the way they process information, the way they see things, and the way they react. And I've noticed in traders that are very, very good, they seem to have more time. And they seem to have these little interregnums where something will be happening. And you can't tell whether they're up a small fortune or they're down a small fortune, because they are just still. And then they make a decision. But it's difficult to get people to that point. It is a struggle, because it's an internal struggle. My view has always been the battles we face in trading are all internal, because we're not programmed very well to be natural traders. We're programmed to do a lot of other things. But trading is a difficult skill for us, because it forces us to revert, as you say, and I like the phrase natural state. And it's one I'm actually going to steal, because it's so good. It forces us to revert to a natural state. And that makes us uncomfortable. We don't want to be there. Simple example. I've recently returned from a yoga retreat in Bali. And I'm quite an insular person. Every night, well, three times a day, I sat down and had breakfast, lunch and dinner with 14 other people. That's the natural state of humans. We have this tribal need. As humans, we no longer do a series of things that are desperately important to our mental health. We no longer eat together. which is a bonding exercise and a defragging exercise, because you talk. We no longer dance together and we no longer sing together. I don't know whether you have them here in the UK, but here one of the mechanisms that we use for treating depression in men is they join choirs. And strangely enough, it acts as a very, very powerful modality for dealing with a depression. And I think it works because it takes them back again to this natural state, and a natural state with a group. So it's a shared experience. You're not in isolation.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I do work for the drop the bad word, UK Parliament. We had some, don't mention Parliament.
You have some interesting characters over there.
And there was this sort of presentation about neuroscience, and people brought them from the outside to, you know, explore, you know, how they manage themselves, and mindfulness was sort of a topic. And this old sort of East London fella that clearly had struggles in his life stood up and says, look, I'm going to be honest with you. This meditation stuff's not for me. However, the fact that I've been taught to go out and tune into my senses when I go for a walk with the dog has been a revelation. Now, yes. Getting to this state of being in a natural state of just being aware, and that's how I'm aware and own the space around me when I connect to other people as well, that sort of social connection. But the one thing he said that was a massive, massive benefit, he says, I'm now starting to sing again. I was encouraged to join a group, and I can't sing, but I go there and sing. And
I don't think it matters.
I'm off of the medication now for depression.
Yes.
And so it made me start to realize as well that, you know, this topic of self-management is far broader than the trend. You know, the trend is kind of like all focused on mindfulness, headspace and all that.
Yes.
Whatever. But at a fundamental level of being, it's, you know, it's huge. And the more simple stuff, it's almost going back to that state as a kid. You know, every kid was singing somewhere. You know, you had school choirs, you had church choirs, you had music lessons. And maybe that's part of the answer. Maybe it is part of the answer, because actually in more in America than in the UK, transcendental meditation, there's a degree of chanting and singing that goes with that. And I noticed myself that there were some songs that I used to like, or little segments of songs, I guess normal songs, but they seemed to be of a certain vibration, you know, a certain tone. And then I started to look more into transcendental meditation and started to find that you could almost go out and choose a chant that fitted your own internal vibration preference as tone. And so there are people exploring this idea that as a being, we're not just, you know, got the physical presence, but we've got some sort of vibrational presence. And if we can tune into that vibrational presence, actually we can start to enhance ourselves to a higher level of thinking. And of course, that has implications for sport performance, but also has implications for trading as well. Because, of course, it's about being your best, but also being yourself. And, you know, there's a balance between both of those things. And it fits into, I'm sure, some of the behavior stuff that Steve does.
Well, Mark, can I just put in there? Because,
yes.
As you know, I suppose where the difference is Mark, you talk about mindfulness and mind fitness. And I think you focus very much on the person. Whereas what I do with a trader is I try and bring people to a state of presence as traders, but by exploring how they are in their job, what they're actually doing, how the market's impacting them, how they're coping with risk, what their environment is, and, you know, then what the relationships are. So it sort of comes in from two slightly different directions. But that last point which you said really struck a chord with me, because I always talk to people and saying, you know, somehow you have to get in sync with the market. if you're not in sync with the market, it really doesn't matter how good your analysis is, or even how good your money management or risk management is, you're not going to succeed, you're not going to trade. And, you know, I go back to my own trading experiences. When I was in sync with the market, that's when I was making money. And there were other times where I just wasn't in sync with the market and I couldn't make money, you know, it was just impossible. You know, I was doing everything that seemed to be right, but I wasn't tuned in with the market.
Yeah, you couldn't buy a winning trade.
Yeah, so you couldn't, yeah, that phrase, you can't buy a winning trade. And sometimes you have to step away. You have to let go, you have to walk back. And, you know, you have to almost, you call it, Mark, and is it reset, refresh?
Okay. Yeah, refresh, reset, recalibrate.
Yes.
In real time. Yes. On demand for that moment.
And that is,
do you think
a real skill?
No, yes. Do you think in part, the part of the issue traders face is that, and particularly in this past 25 years, the world has been infected, I would call it, by this mad pursuit of happiness, that you must always be happy, that you must always be full bottle, that you must always be living life to its fullest. And that so when traders run into these barren patches, this clashes dramatically with the worldview they've been presented with. And so that they automatically fall back on this notion that they might be a failure because they don't actually understand that it doesn't matter what you do. You have natural ebbs and flows. And sometimes you just have to, as you say, step out and hit the reset button and just dial your emotions down a little bit, change your expectations down a little bit, and then re-engage. And I wonder whether that's been your experience.
Yes, 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 and yes again.
And yes.
Yeah.
So spot on. And, you know, I almost can't sort of put the answer into words because you've hit the nail on the head, and I don't think I need to elaborate on that, really. Mark, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, there is this old story of this monk that spent 5 years meditating up in some cave. And he felt it was time that he had his toolkit to manage himself to go down to the village to, you know, reconnect with the village. So he went down to the village and he was moving around the hustle bustle as the village were greeting this great character. I have not seen him for 5 years. This young kid stepped on his foot, and the monk raised his staff to hit the kid. And at that point, the monk put down his stick, turned around, and went back up the hill to go and meditate.
Start again.
So, you have to start again. Now, the trouble is, you know, you don't want to be doing something that takes you too much away from life either.
No.
And I've known some people that will tell you that, you know, that they're committing to this and they're committing to that, and, you know, and they're kind of like almost like straining to commit to this sort of way of living. And I think both of those have had mental breakdowns because they kind of don't have that balance of, you know, we need to get on with life and the fact that it's ebb and flow and, you know, there's a real world out there, and if you tune in a sensible way, then, hey, you flourish. But if you tune in a way that actually takes you super far away from the present, you might be doing yourself some harm.
But they're looking for answers outside of themselves when, you know, all the answers are within them.
Exactly.
This is almost the overriding philosophy of the work I do as a coach, is that you have all the answers within you, all the solutions are within you. And sometimes my clients get a little bit frustrated with me because they want me to give them the answers. They want me to come along with solutions. And I always say to them, I don't have your solutions. I only have my solutions. So what I do is I don't give you them. I ask you questions that will help you find the solutions. And I will make suggestions that you can reject or you can think about or you can accept, but they're not answers. You have to find the answers, and I will be the catalyst for that process. But they have to be your answers.
I'm saying that that some people want that answer without any sort of effort. Right, but some of this stuff needs commitment. You know, commitment to working on yourself. And there's sort of a phrase in the mindfulness world that, you know, you practice mindfulness to a point where actually, you know, if you do it right and have the right model, at some point mindfulness starts to practice you. So you get to kind of have this stuff on access whenever you need it. But that takes some degree of measured commitment to get there. I think you can translate that into the trader world, that actually you could actually add to the problem if you feel that you're not getting these answers that are popping up as ready as you really, really want them, because actually you've not put the commitment in. Well, you know, which is the commitment to find a coach, for example. You know, you need to work on these things.
Yeah, I'm so glad there's somebody else who says to people, A, you know the answer. B, you need to find it. C, I'm just going to occasionally nudge you in the right direction, because I've driven numerous individuals insane over the past two decades pointing it out to them.
Yeah.
My view is, take a simple thing. Everybody knows how to lose weight. Everybody does. It's a thermodynamic equation. But there's no free ride. Nobody defeats the second law of thermodynamics. And the answer is simple. If I lined 100 people up against the wall and said, how do you lose weight? They would all say, eat less, move more. But because of, you know, these psychosocial impediments they have, they've got the answer. They just can't quite get there. So they need someone who sits there and in many ways acts the role of, I hate to say it, this will get me into trouble, the nagging wife. Why did you do that? Why do you think that? Why do you think this might be? Because I actually think the role of a mentor or a coach or anyone is to question.
Yes.
It's not to give answers. And this is the role in academia as well when I was there. If you're mentoring students and that they're struggling with a problem, you don't write the problem out for them. You say, well, have you read this journal? Have you spoken to this person? Have you considered maybe starting here? To just give people the answer is, I mean, it's a lazy solution. And look, it does suit the lazy approach for most people, because when we think about it, humans by and large will, if possible, default to a minimum energy state. And asking and answering your own questions can be immensely stressful and very taxing on the psyche and the soul.
Well, I go back because I experienced this firsthand as a trader. So if I could tell you, sort of go back a little bit. So I'm a coach now, but my journey to coaching started with being coached, and that was in the year 2000.
Yes.
So I was given an executive coach. I was a trader at Commerzbank in London, and almost as an experiment, they put me with this executive coach. And I had six meetings with him, which lasted an hour and a half over 6 months, where I talked about my trading and how I worked, and he asked me questions. And that started a kind of awakening. You know, at that point, I'm not going to lie, I was probably going backwards in my career as a trader. You know, life happens to you, and life had happened to me. You know, my early career was very much on an upward curve. And then it started leveling off and slowly moving backwards. And he allowed me to see myself, and he allowed me to start to see where I was in the world, who I was, how I was, who I'd become. And it started that process of self-examination and self-exploration. Now, until then, I'd been on a 10-year journey of probably reading every single book on markets, every single autobiography. I'd probably read Market Wizards every 6 months. I'd read all the self-help
as we do.
Yeah, and none of them had really, they'd taken me, they'd been really great. I love reading, and I implore anyone to do this stuff, but they hadn't really taken me into myself. And working with a coach, he held up a metaphorical mirror to me, and suddenly I saw who I was, and I started to self-adjust. And that's when suddenly, it was like hitting the reset button. And that's when I started to become a good trader. And I became a, by my own, I'm not going to, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I became a very good trader after that. And I always had that within me. And I always think everyone has that within them, but very few
Do
people
you?
get a chance to experience
Yeah.
that. And 10 years
I,
later,
I,
the very same coach suggested that, I should become a coach, which is how I then moved into this space here. I love the idea. I realize I've interrupted you.
No. I was just going to perhaps posit a question, and that is, do you perhaps think it was one of those situations that, that old hackneyed expression of when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And that's been my experience in life with people who've coached me physically, intellectually, emotionally, that you get to a point, or almost like a tipping point, where you're looking, and you're often looking subconsciously. And as such, you don't know what you're looking for, but suddenly it just seems to appear. And without you realizing it, all of a sudden the path you are on either becomes clearer, different, or more settled. And I wonder whether it's for those of us involved in this space that sometimes we appear, but the student's not ready. And I'm certain both of you have had that experience where you're giving it 10 tenths, and they're not a blank slate. They're actually their own version of the Berlin Wall that you can't get beyond.
And
Can I just
the
jump in
irony
on?
was, I just want to say you're absolutely right. I think you're spot on there. And the irony was that I nearly rejected it at first. My
Which is what
ego
you do.
jumped in the way and said, well, I don't need a coach. I don't need a teacher. I don't need a mentor. I don't, that's how I saw it. I saw it as infantilizing me in some way and belittling me. So actually, I at first pushed back on what became the greatest opportunity I could have had. And now, as a coach, I experience this with traders all the time, who some ask the question and then go, no, I don't think I need it. Other ones ask me to work with, their manager asks me to work with them, but they push back and say they don't need it. So yes, it is something. I think you have to be ready for it, and the time has to be right.
Yes, so
No, sorry, go
can
ahead,
I
sorry.
just chime in? Do you know that this happened to me? I changed a career path because I had the right mindset at the moment that the opportunity was appearing. Mindset and personal state of being as well. I think you've alluded to it earlier, Chris, but if you're in a state of being where you've just you got stress and you're not self-managed, and you've got a mindset that's not optimal, then an opportunity can be sitting there at the front, in the front of your face, at the end of your nose, and you're not going to be seeing it. And I think it's the biggest tragedy of life for people if they are stuck in the wrong mindset. All these opportunities with all the optionality around it could be popping up in front of them for different pathways, and they're totally blind to them. And of course, Steve, that moment turned up for you when you were in the right mindset and the right opportunity came up and you pursued it and you made a great success of it. And I'm not saying that's a common thing
That's
because of the
not.
way life is. A lot of people are in this mindset that's just, you're kind of inward looking rather than outward looking. And yet,
Yes.
greatest opportunities in life come from having the right state of being to notice that, hey, that's an opportunity I want to not just grab, but grab it tightly and go that way with it. Sorry for butting in, but
I think our experience all runs parallel. And I often get into trouble for saying to people that people often bemoan where they are in life and all these bits, other bits and pieces, as we all hear. And I will often say to someone, well, you are where you are because that's where you want to be. If you didn't want to be there, you'd be on a different path. And this gets enormous pushback. And I think it's pushback because at some subconscious level, it resonates with people. And they have this brief insight into themselves and their own behavior. And then they shut it down. And the easiest way to shut it down is to shut down the messenger, which is what we have seen with people who we've tried to guide and mentor, is that when either of you appear for a trader, that what happens is that even those who push back the hardest are probably those in this odd paradox who realize subconsciously that they're the ones who desperately need it the most. I'll give an example that's outside of trading. I mentioned that I'm involved in yoga. For years, people tried to get me involved in yoga, and my body had gotten to a point from a decade of full contact martial arts competition internationally, playing rugby, powerlifting, doing all those testosterone-filled things that young men do without much forethought, where it was broken. But I kept pushing back against it, saying, are you stupid? Do I really look like one of those skinny buggers who pounces around in a loincloth on a mat chanting, not fully understanding what yoga was, just being a bit of a peanut? And I, looking back on it over the years, I think the pushback from me came so hard because part of me was going, you do actually need it. Your body is aging. You have broken it. And you need something to center you at this point in time, both physically and mentally. And so when I have people push back against me, I now sort of sit there and go, okay, it's not working now, but there probably will come a time when it will work for you because you will you'll either blow up or boomerang back. Either way, we will probably meet again, which may be your experience with people as well.
I think that it all goes back to natural self, okay?
Yeah.
The basic principle is if you can't achieve natural self, don't know how to achieve natural self, then you're not going to be able to cope with challenges and commit to different types of opportunities. The space is difficult, and if you do it without a toolkit, you all fall to yourself, really. I think that our own experiences together, whilst different, you know, there's this commonality of pursuing and committing that has given us all these tools that are allowing us to flourish. Breaking the stigma, accepting that we have moments that are difficult, but we have to sort of deal with them and move on. And the solution may seem to have a stigma around it. You know, yoga, as you mentioned, or mindfulness or meditation, people think, oh, I don't want to get near that stuff because,
it's
being conditioned to think in a certain way, it means a certain thing. Well, it doesn't. Actually, it sort of gets back to you, gets to achieving something called your natural state, your natural self. And there's huge power in learning to pause. And what you're doing, and for those that are thinking, you know, we've got, as you mentioned, Chris, about, you know, the battles that we face, the biggest weapon that you've got is to be able to weaponize your mind to fight whatever those battles are and to be your ultimate warrior in actually, you know, having some degree of processing control around decision-making, knowing when to engage, knowing when not to engage, knowing how to how to appropriately behave under certain circumstances and be responsive to surprises that turn up from left field, and to manage them without, starting World War III. You know, that's that's the world we're in. We're going back to that always on state of these people coming from the always on state of connectivity, and how do you deal with this new world called trading you want to dip your feet into? Well, you start with yourself and you commit to managing yourself on an ongoing basis of learning.
That's the wonderfully paradoxical thing about trading, is that people's first entree is pick up every book they can find on technical analysis, quantitative analysis, fundamental analysis, and think that that is the be-all and end-all, and that it begins and ends with reading Benjamin Graham cover to cover, as opposed to, well, that's merely the technical execution thereof. That's not the driver of the tool, because the driver of the tool is what goes on between your ears. I used to have this little game I used to play with MBA students and say, look, point to the market for me. And this is back in the day when we had trading floors here in Australia, and they'd vaguely point to the CBD. And I'd go, no, Peanut, it's actually between your ears. So it becomes whatever you want it to be. If you want it to be threatening and fearful and aggressive, then it will be. If you want it to simply be a natural state of flow, where sometimes you're out of sync, as we've said, sometimes you're out of rhythm, then it will be that. But one leads to longevity and a peaceful, happy approach, and the other one tends to lead to a nervous breakdown.
And do you know what? Just sort of hearing you say about that, sort of kind of slightly reframing this. Get that bang, that noise. I'll start that again. So coming back to what you, or following on from what you said then, I want to slightly reframe that in a sense that so much energy and effort is put into trying to find the answer to the next market move, like you said, with technical analysis and with fundamental analysis and economic analysis. And actually so much goes into planning and preparation for a trade. But the problem is that so few people can actually stick to that trade when it's on.
Yes.
You know, even people who are systematic. So I just recently worked with a fund with their systematic traders, and there was a huge problem of overfitting and curve fitting in the design of the systems, which just shows that, you know, people are not trusting themselves with all the analysis they're doing. And it comes back to that word, selves, not trusting selves. You know, this whole thing is about yourself. You know, it's, I use a quote, which I've slightly adapted from a Sir Edmund Hillary comment, which I've always put on my work. And it's not the market we conquer, it's ourselves. And that is the very point of this job. It's not about your analysis. It's not about your plans even, or your system. They're all tools, they're all techniques, they're all methods, and you need to be as good as them as you can be. But ultimately it comes down to yourself, the person executing, the person managing the risk, the person putting the system on and sitting with the system and then reviewing it and looking back at it and then stepping away from it and then starting again with the next trade after resetting and being in sync with the market. It's all about yourself more than it is about the system.
I don't know how you go about it, but I often have a difficulty getting people to divorce themselves from the tool. Because, as you say, they're obsessed by the tool. They think the tool is everything, whereas the tool is merely the implement of execution. And once execution has begun, then all bets are off for your tool. And it really is your battle. And so divorcing people from their methodology, and particularly now, when, as you say, dealing with systematic or quantitative traders, dealing with quants can be a nightmare for everybody because they're so rigidly adherent to what the program says, and I think that solves everything for them. So when there's something aberrant occurs, they're all at sea. They can't function because they don't have the mental map to actually deal with it. And I don't know whether that's your experience as well, that the more quantitative or the more highly intelligent a trader is, actually the more difficult they are to, I won't say manage, but perhaps coach and guide.
I think that comes down to emotional intelligence. To some, when I work with some, when I work with some who are very highly emotionally intelligent, I mean, it's almost a perfect recipe. You've got intellectual intelligence and emotional intelligence that are incredibly high. And I think the emotional intelligence quotient is far more important than the intellectual intelligence quotient.
Oh, good Lord, yes, yes.
But also, most people in trading rooms are often the most siloed of anybody.
That's a really good observation.
So they tend to be very self-centered in terms of their work ethic, almost to the point of being secretive. And I think because of the way that, you know, they've been labelled as rocket scientists, whatever, they are, of course, never wrong, which is a fatal mistake. And as such, you know, they're often very resistant in being told what to do. The way they've come into the role, which I think, of course, presents a challenge to someone like Steve. But of course, by the sound of it, Steve, it looks like you've found a way of getting around that. But I'm sure you can see where the problem stems from.
Yeah. Well, not everyone's resistant to it. There will be, you do get people who are very resistant, who refuse to let go of certain totemic aspects of who they are, and they can't break past it. So it's, you know, it's not going to work with everyone, but quite often those people won't even, sort of come to the coaching.
No,
that's true. That's true. They self-select.
Yeah.
But I think that also touches on the point, which is, I think, a very important one in that, for example, I am emotionally and physically ill-equipped to play golf. My view is that if you can't pick the ball up, run with it, kick it, and run into other people, why would you bother having the ball? And P.S., by the way, I've been given a weapon. Why can't I hit someone with the stick? I'm just not equipped. And so it's this matter of, I think some people, and this is a very hard conversation I have to have with people, that some people either can't trade in certain ways and are more suited towards a longer way of investment sort of approach, or they can't trade full stop. They're better off finding somebody who can and living vicariously through them, because the framework is just not there and probably never will be there. And no amount of coaching, cajoling, poking, prodding will ever get them to that point. And I think all that happens in these situations is that unless you have the conversation with people, you're really just feeding back into their own despair. Because sometimes you have to, I've found, you have to have very difficult conversations with people once you've got to know them, often over the space of years. And you have to simply say to them, look, you have skills, but they're not here. And you just have to accept that that is the way of your universe present.
But it's interesting you say that. And I'm first of all going to say I'm mindful of the time. So we've slightly gone over how much time we allocated to this. So maybe we'll start trying to wind it up. I was going to ask you some questions, which I had sent you, which some listeners of the previous podcast had sent in. Now, we're not going to have time to do that. So maybe we have to save that for another time. But you've touched on one question that someone sent in, which was a question about personality. I've referred to in previous podcasts about some of the personality tests I use with traders. And one particular personality assessment, which identifies people's risk profiles or risk personalities. And this listener, Jordan, had asked for more on the styles of trading products which suited certain personality types and traits, if possible. So I'm not going to have time. We're not going to have time to go into that right now. But I've noticed over the years that there are, in the way you've described that you would never be a good golfer because you don't physically have that makeup, there are certain personality types that are never going to be good at a certain type of trading or a certain style of trading. So one of the things that we've noticed with this personality assessment is that people who are very good at very short-term trading, very fast trading, what we would call sort of spot FX type trading.
Yes, yeah.
Are almost diametrically opposed to the sort of person who is very good at running an options portfolio, taking a more portfolio approach, a more slower type of trading, a more perhaps thoughtful approach to risk, that more personality mindset. And I don't think any amount of coaching is going to be able to change one person to be good at the other one. You know, and if they go to the right sort of trading approach and trading project and trading style for their personality, they're far more likely to succeed. In the same way that you at 6'4" and 110 kilograms, no matter how good you are, is never going to be a good, you're never going to be a good jockey in horse riding, if that was ever your ambition.
Yes, I mean, my teachers were surprised when I put that down for Careers Day. But what you say is true, and it comes back to the very simple point, and it's a good point to probably wrap up on, and that is that everybody needs to find their game and play their game, not play somebody else's game or the game they think they should actually play. Because if you are suited to trading, there will be, as you say, a niche somewhere that your aptitude, personality, emotional makeup slots into. But that the problem I find with traders is that, for example, Australians are early adopters of financial technology. So everybody in Australia for a decade thought they should be trading spot FX, despite the fact that the majority of people are not made up for that. And so they had to go away and either give up, which was, you know, a loss on their behalf, or find what they could actually do.
Yeah, I think that's brilliantly put. And I think that actually brings this to a really nice ending. Mark, do you have any final thoughts before we sort of close off this episode?
Well, I think it's, I guess, great to hear Chris with so much of his work, running in parallel to exactly what we're doing over here or on the other side of the earth. You know, I think the Australians have got a very sport-orientated culture, and I think coaching and performance is perhaps more acceptable generally over in that part of the world than what I see here in the UK. It's not the case in the US. It's very much, you know, it's a similar, you know, philosophy of acceptance. Yes. Coaching is there as well. But I think, you know, UK needs to wake up to the fact that, you know, people need to drop that stiff upper lip and engage with people that can change their lives and change their profitability, because it all starts of, if you're not managing your natural state of being, then, you know, good luck. But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, Chris, and
thank you.
I hope we can also stay in touch and carry on with this conversation.
Probably the point I would like to leave is twofold. One, an invitation to both you gentlemen for us to return the favour and have you chat with us on our podcast.
Love to.
But also a final point for traders, and that is that it's been my observation over the years that a trader's bank balance will very, very rarely exceed the level of their own emotional intelligence.
That's great. Thank you very much, Chris. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. We'd love to come back on your podcast one day.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
That'd be brilliant. No, I was just going to say thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been a blast.
Thank you once again to Chris Tate from The Trading Game from Australia for joining us. It was a pleasure to hear his thoughts, and I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it half as much as we enjoyed doing it. Further to this, please, if you did enjoy it, once again, we'd ask you to rate us on iTunes. That helps us move up the rankings on iTunes and helps spread the word of the work we're doing on the Alpha Mind podcast. We have other resources as well. You can check out our website, although that's still in the early stages of development. That's alpha-mind.net. The Alpha Mind blog, alphamindblog.blogspot.com. That has lots of articles which we've written over the years, and also other resources on there. We have a page which talks about the Trader Performance Coaching Program, books on trader mindset, books on courses on technical analysis, and a list of other podcasts. You know, there are some great resources out there in the podcast world, and we highly recommend traders listen to podcasts. As I read somewhere, you know, podcasts are the tutors for the masses, and they are free. You can also follow us on social media. I'm Stephen Goldstein at AlphaMind101, Mark Randall on Twitter at The Mind Guys, and also on social media on LinkedIn. We have a thriving group on LinkedIn where we publish lots of articles. It's called the Alpha Mind Group, naturally, and you can also post some articles that are relative to the subject and theory of trading mindset. So feel free to engage with us on that. Other than that, it's just really to say thank you again for listening, and please tune in again next week for the latest edition. And also, you know, we have a thriving back catalogue of some great interviews with traders, psychologists, coaches, analysts. So, you know, they're full of education, people sharing their views on trading, performance, mindset, psychology, all these other intangible aspects of trading. That just leaves me to say, have a great week, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.